everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. Mixing it up a little. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
Speaking in a halting fashion like Christopher Walken. Welcome to We've Got Mail. My name is Whitney Seibold. I do the really bad Christopher Walken impersonation.
We apologize to Christopher Walken. Except for Wild Mountain Time.
That one's on you.
Your Irish accent was not your best, Chris. We love you. We think you're one of the finest actors of your generation. I even liked you in that movie, but your accent?
He's been in his share of quite bad films.
Oh, haven't we all?
Indeed. I'll say this, though. I wasn't in The Country Bears.
You can say a lot of things about Whitney Seibold, but if you say he's in The Country Bears, we will slap that down. Anyway, this is We've Got Mail. It's the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. We invite all of our listeners to write in to letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We take questions, critiques, concerns. You want to hear recommendations. You want to recommend stuff to us and our listeners. You basically just get the floor. The floor is yours. We try to get to as many letters as we possibly can every single week. We will never catch up because you write in a lot, and we're very grateful for that. But we do the best we can, and we don't like to dilly-dally right at the front of the episode. So, Whitney, let's just hop right in.
All right. Here's a letter from someone calling themselves the Windy, maybe the Vindy.
Okay.
Hello, Mr. Bibbs and Mr. Rockmeister McCool.
Hi.
That's my name on the show is Rockmeister McCool.
That's true.
First things first, thank you for yet another year of amazing podcasts all around.
Thank you.
I listen to all your free podcasts, and simultaneously I'm working on the huge Patreon backlog. Oh, my goodness.
It's a lot if you just jump in now.
Yeah.
I always think to myself, God, we don't do enough. And I'm like, yeah, if you join in now, there's like quite a lot.
It's like a thousand hours of content waiting for
that's
you.
That's probably an exaggeration, but at least
I don't want to say content anymore.
No, we need to stop.
I'm trying
doing
to break
that.
Myself of that habit.
Reducing the stuff that we create, whether you consider it art or even just entertainment, it's not content. That's just content is just stuff that fills the space.
Well, content is the business term for art.
Yeah,
like we're going to sell the content to the consumer.
Its meaning is nothing. The important thing is that we have something to sell. So we need to stop calling it content. Mm-hmm. But the podcasts that we make, the work that we do, there's a lot of it over there. It's at least a few hundred hours at this point.
Anyway, you really outdid yourselves this year in terms of the sheer number of episodes you released while maintaining an amazing quality. I'm looking forward to another year of this. Well, we're going to keep on doing this as long as we can until we drop.
Which is actually increasingly often. we're trying to maintain a schedule here, but we do a lot of shoes.
Or work-life balance, or work-work balance.
Very, very tricky.
Anyways, as a lot of listeners do this time of year, I will also share my personal top 10 films with you.
Yay!
Please note, I live in Austria, so some of these movies had a U.S. release in 2019. As for the same reason, a lot of these movies I keep hearing great things about are not available here yet, like Promising Young Woman, First Cow, Possessor, Palm Springs, Synchronic, and so many more. And because of time reasons, I was not able to watch some others, like Da Five Bloods, 40-Year-Old Virgin, and a few others, yet, even though they are available. So, enough rambling, here are my top 10.
Cool.
The Vindy lists them 1 to 10. I think I'm going to count down to 10 to 1, just for dramatic purposes.
Okay, so we get the impression that these are ranked.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So number 10 is Onward. Even though I really liked Soul, this one resonated with me more, and I think the world they created is believable. However did they manage that? Number 9, Birds of Prey.
I feel like
Prey.
I want to see a TV show based on Onward.
Just set in like modern elf world.
That's a good point. I like the world. The world is fun. Like, I would like to see the ongoing adventures of these characters. Mm. I just felt maybe it wasn't quite enough to bolster like one important movie. Maybe that's my issue with it. But it's a cute little film.
I dug Onward. I thought it was quite good. Yeah. Number 9, Birds of Prey.
Yay!
I'm with Bibbs on that. Sorry, Ruckmeister. Just keep doing that, DC. Number 8, Emma. So much energy in that film. Anya Taylor-Joy is the gift that keeps on giving.
I really gotta see that film.
Number 7, The Farewell. This was a film that came out in the U.S. last year. Such a quietly beautiful movie. It's a very specific setting with a universal story everyone can relate to. Number 6, The Invisible Man. One of the most terrifying films of the year, and Elizabeth Moss, what else is there to say? Number 5, Weathering With You. Probably the most beautiful animation in a long time. It makes you feel like you are in Tokyo, even though I've never been. Yeah, I'd missed Weathering With You.
Yeah, I heard a lot of really, really good things. I remember when Your Name came out, and a lot of people went absolutely gaga for it. And I liked it fine. I actually thought it lost its way in like the second half. Mm-hmm. So I didn't love it the way other people did, but I heard really good things about Weathering With You, and I need to get around to that.
Number four, Jojo Rabbit. A really powerful message about hate. Also one of the funniest movies without too often crossing the line. Number three, Little Women. A beautiful movie that is just so smart, and did I say beautiful? Number two, Color Out of Space. Genre cinema as it ought to be. Great cast all around. The soundtrack is fantastic. And number one, Saint Maud. A film I didn't see. An amazing character study that left me riveted.
Did that come out? Because there's like a couple of like major horror releases that like keep getting pushed back. Like we were supposed to get Candyman, we didn't get Candyman. Yeah. Was Saint Maud one of the ones that didn't get released in America yet, or hasn't been?
I think it did, like barely.
I think I just missed it. Dang it. Okay.
Yeah, like I remember when it was about to come out.
Yeah, it was supposed to be in like April. Yeah. And like it just, well, shit happened.
But. I think it ended up. You know what? I think it's still coming in the United States.
It played Fantastic Fest.
Yeah, like it opened in like festivals and stuff. But I don't think it's had a proper release.
It's supposed to come out later this month.
Okay. So we'll be
allegedly
on it,
the 29th for who knows if that'll stick around. Or IMDb has two dates. It has the 29th and the 12th. So I think 29th is like a limited theatrical and then the 12th is like
February 12th.
February 12th. Yeah, it's like Amazon or wherever you get your
Shutter, wherever it's going to be streaming.
Yeah, probably not Shutter.
But yeah, number one, Saint Maud. Pretty cool.
I've heard really good things.
Thank you for reading my email. And if not, that's okay too. Yours the Vindy.
Well, thank you for your email. And we love hearing these lists. We really, really do. We like being able to give people space to talk about the films that they liked that we didn't see or even that they liked more than us. Mm. Again, it's a great big universe. We're all really puny. We're just tiny little specks.
Oh, please stop.
About the size of Mickey Rooney.
I had that cassette as well.
But we love hearing your perspectives, and we love hearing what movies. I also like hearing what movies ended up coming out in other countries at different times.
Yeah,
like the fact that The Farewell and Little Women and
Jojo Rabbit
were films that were 2020 films in a lot of other places is completely just the reality in which we live.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of people would be like, hey, those came out in 20, like in America. Like we can't
Hey Americans, there are other countries.
Yeah. It's all perfectly valid. Like we default to America cause we're Americans. And that makes sense to us. But like, yeah, we get it. Mm-hmm. Movies come out whenever they come out. So yeah, perfectly valid.
Here's a letter from Cameron. Hello, Cameron.
Hi, Cameron.
Hello, Bibbs and David Arquette, pronounced Rockmeister McCool. It's a new spelling. As I've said, there is no incorrect spelling for Rockmeister McCool. All the spellings are correct.
Someone's just going to send us, like, Dear Bibbs and, like, all of James Joyce. And then at the end of, like, Ulysses, it just says, pronounce Rockmeister McCool.
Dear Bibbs and Stately Plump Buck Mulligan. I'm 23 years old. I've only seriously gotten into film since I was around 19 or 20, so obviously I have a lot of catching up to do. I've made a lot of headway in 2020, catching up with the films of John Carpenter and Wes Craven, and all of the classic Universal monster movies.
Yay!
But through all of that, I feel like I've been slacking off on seeing new releases. I only saw about 70 in 2020, which I know is a lot to most people, but it's way less than I had in 2018 and 2019. I want to expand my base of knowledge about the history of film, especially stuff from before I was born. But I also want to be able to stay cognizant of contemporary films that contribute to the discourse that are there.
Yep.
Any tips for striking that balance? Thanks. Keep up the great work and take care of yourselves while you do it, Cameron.
The only thing to me, only thing that's actually tricky in that is keeping up with the new releases, because the new releases, their availability comes and goes. Mm. I mean, nowadays, most stuff is going like straight to VOD. But typically, in a typical year, they'll come to theaters and it'll be gone for a while, and then you won't be able to access it, and then it'll be on Blu-ray or whatever. And so it's a little hard to keep up with the constant flow of the new stuff. So my general rule of thumb is if you really want to stay cognizant of new releases, that's the more time-sensitive stuff. So, like, if there's something you want to see and it just came out,
you want to be part of the Twitter conversation.
Yeah, when I think that conversation, whether it's on Twitter or elsewhere, is kind of important, because that's where we're sort of laying the groundwork for what do we think of this. Mm-hmm. And if you might agree with the general consensus, but if you don't, it's a really good time to speak up and to actually be part of that conversation so that we can have a more nuanced, balanced interesting conversation rather than I liked it. Great. Then we'll never talk about it again. So, and then in the cracks, whenever you have free time, that's when you see the old stuff. Mm. So, you know, you plan to see a couple of new releases a week, whatever you're comfortable with, whatever you have the time and money for. And then when you're not doing that, throw in something old.
Yeah.
See, whenever you can. Like, I don't have a lot of time to see stuff that's just for me. Mm. You know, it's just for fun, just for my own personal education or just interests. But whenever I do, yay! What a wonderful night!
The other night I saw Torque for the first time.
Oh,
just for pleasure.
Oh my God, I love Torque so much.
It's rare that I get to watch a movie just for fun.
What did you think of Torque?
Torque is just a wonderfully stupid piece of crap.
Yep.
It is so enjoyable. Like, it. Imagine, I don't know if you were ever bullied by jocks at your school,
mm-hmm.
but I have some pretty vivid memories of like having my face stuffed in another human being's armpit on more than one occasion. Sometimes, sometimes in an athletic scenario, sometimes not.
Yeah.
Imagine that odor mixed with spilled Budweiser at a mall. That's the odor of Torque.
That's a compliment.
It's certainly descriptive. It is the that kind of gross maleness and alcohol kind of congealed together and turned into a motorcycle movie. I watched it with my wife. Mm-hmm. She had just seen it for the first time recently, so it was her second time through.
Mm-hmm.
And
she wanted to watch it again.
She wanted to watch it again, and even after the second time, she could not make sense of the plot.
Oh, it's
like the plot is absurd. It doesn't make any sense. You don't know the motivation.
It's about
of the characters.
It's about three biker gangs, and one biker gang's bad, and they make the other biker gangs fight each other,
meth,
and that's it.
There's like meth hidden inside of motorcycles, but who has them at any given moment is a little amorphous.
And every action sequence is more absurd than the last. Mm. And like the last one is basically just a motorcycle that moves so fast it destroys a city,
yeah, more or less.
Yeah, which is a lot of fun. There's a big motorcycle fight where two people literally use motorcycles to hit each other.
They're motorcycle fighting.
It's super great. Yeah. One of my favorite things in that movie is there's a bit where Martin Henderson from the remake of The Ring, back in that brief moment where he thought he'd be a big deal, he's being chased.
He's actually Sam Worthington. It's the same person.
Oh, interesting.
He just keeps changing his name.
He's being chased by Ice Cube because Ice Cube thinks he killed his brother or something like that. And Ice Cube chases him on top of like a speeding bullet train.
It's just a regular Amtrak.
But they shoot it like it's a bullet train. They shoot it like it's a speed.
They're riding motorcycles on the top of the train. And in order to elude capture, Martin Henderson manages to somehow sidle his motorcycle down into the car and zips at equal speed down the middle of the crowded passenger car.
There's a bit at the end of that action sequence that I don't think I've seen in hardly any action movie, and I really appreciated it, where after all of that, Martin Henderson was like, that was weird. That was so crazy what we just did. Can you believe what I just did? Mm. Okay, anyway, back to the plot. Like, just one moment where Thor was like, I just fought the Hulk in a gladiator arena. Can I just appreciate that I had a weird day? Like, just once. I like them to acknowledge that what they do is weird. That it was a weird, hard day we just had. And I kind of like that. Torque is full of little moments like that that I like.
Torque is absurd.
Yeah. But in any case, yeah, we got way off track. But that's the thing, is you find the time to do the research on the old stuff whenever you can.
Yeah.
But I find myself, the balance is, because the current release stuff is a bit more pressing, time is more of a factor, I prioritize that a little bit, but I always try to make time for at least a couple of things around the week.
Well, here's a good guide, and this is something that sort of guided me through this phenomenon you're describing of being wanting to balance the old and the new. It's critics. You read a review of a new film, read a couple reviews of a new film, and you're going to run into a reference to an older film. There's like allude to something that that the critic noticed influenced the film they're watching.
Yeah.
Even if it's a piece of crap, they'll talk about it. Sometimes, you'll run into a review of some like really trashy piece of garbage, but just to sort of counterbalance the argument, the critic will bring up Ingmar Bergman. Yeah. Watch that movie.
Well, you know, I remember...
Like, use that as sort of your double feature with the new film you just saw.
I mean, we have a whole podcast called Episode Zero, which is all dedicated to the movies that inspired popular movies. But we actually did this for a while in our first podcast, where we would look at the new releases and we'd each recommend a B feature.
Yeah.
Something that relates. Maybe it's by the same filmmaker, or maybe it's thematically appropriate in some way. I'm trying to think of, like, what's, like, something recent we could consider... In that, like, what came out, like, towards the end of last year? Like, what was a big movie towards Wonder Woman 1984?
All right.
What's like, a movie you would recommend? Like, an older movie? A couple of movie or two you'd recommend? Like, you're interested in Wonder Woman 1984, whether or not you dug it. What would be some older movies to sort of, that would go along with it very, very well?
George Cukor's The Women.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. Right. Yeah, I like that a lot.
Watch George Cukor's The Women after you watch Wonder Woman 1984. It's a better movie.
I dig it. Yeah. I dig it. That's
or don't they watch a movie? No, I guess they don't. In Wonder Woman.
No, not really. No.
Like, you watch It Chapter 2 and you can chase that with A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5 because they watch that movie in the movie.
That's true, yeah. No, I'm trying to think if there's anything like... No, I don't think... I'm trying to think of what came out in 1984. Watch 1984.
the 1984 film.
Yeah, 1984. Why not? Yeah, they knew what they were doing. It's 1984. Shit, we better make a 1984.
It's a pretty good movie version of the book.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people like it a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I digress. We can move on.
Here is another
Watch record. Wishmaster. There you go. Oh, that's there the you movie go. Watch Wonder Woman 1984.
Wishmaster,
it's actually a better version of the Wishmaster plot.
It's the same plot, just, yeah.
But cooler.
But way, way more awesome gore.
Yeah, the makeup effects are amazing. The wish storytelling is actually pretty clever, and it's cool.
There's a scene where somebody falls over and then their skeleton gets up without them. and they stretch through their flesh and leave all this glop behind. It's really awesome.
Cool. Yeah.
Anyway, here's a letter from Jinxie. Hello, Jinxie. Dear Critically Acclaimed, I tend to pick watching an older movie over newer ones.
Oh, we have a theme
here, yeah. And I live in a more rural area, which hasn't mattered much this year, but for one of my picks, it meant traveling all morning to a theater, watching the movie, and then coming home. This might seem like a complaint, but those are actually some of the best days, and I really miss them.
You okay?
Answers are just a little hoarse. A lot of podcasting.
Yeah.
Taking a note from Ticklish Business, I give you great my podcast. Top 10 movies I discovered in 2020.
Oh, that's nice, yeah.
In no order except for my number one. Emma, 2020. Seeing the costumes that were based on real historic dresses and the historical hairstyles was truly a joy. Paris Blues, 1961. Sidney Poitier and Paul Newman are jazz musicians who fall in love with two women while visiting Paris. Poitier has to decide if he loves Diane Carroll enough to return to the racism that he's found in the U.S. His part of the film is fascinating with a really important debate. Newman having to worry that he'll lose his artistic abilities by settling down didn't do too much for me, but it makes Poitier's plight all the more pointed.
I haven't seen that one.
Plus, there's a scene where Louis Armstrong brings his jazz band and challenges Newman and Poitier to a jazz fight.
That's awesome.
Any movie can be improved by doing something similar. Yeah, more jazz fights in movie, please. Birds of Prey. This movie was great fun, but Whitney is right in how it could be improved.
Someone pointed out online, like, your comment that Birds of Prey could have been dramatically improved with, like, more shots of, like, Harley kicking some dude's nuts into oblivion.
Yeah.
Just any guy, really. And, yeah, you found a way to improve it. No one's arguing that. That would make it even better.
I wanted more chaos and violence in that movie.
Yeah.
The Women, 1939.
Hey, you just talked about
George Cukor does an amazing job of filming a movie with only women in a satisfying way. I really appreciate how witty this movie is. Little Women, 2019.
Yay.
I've seen all the Little Women movies and most of the miniseries. I've skipped the William Shatner one because I've heard it's not great.
There was a William Shatner one. Oh, my God.
He plays Joe. I really enjoyed this take on it, and Bibbs is basically right about why. I wish they had put Bob Odenkirk in the movie. They hadn't put Bob Odenkirk in the movie. Pulls me out of the movie every time.
He's weird casting, and he comes in like right in the middle, and I think a lot of people are like, oh. I think if he'd been there from the beginning, we wouldn't have questioned it, but because he shows up in the middle, it's a little distracting. Well, I can appreciate that.
And the out of sequence, like out of chronology storytelling threw me at one point.
Yeah.
Because I thought that he had come back after his death and was like, this character reminds us of our father so much that we're just going to get the same actor to play. Oh, wait, it's just in the past. I'm sorry.
That didn't confuse me, but I can see why that would
kinda,
be weird.
Kind of whiffed me a little bit.
Yeah.
Citizen Kane, 1941. Not much to say. It's very good. Though not my favorite Orson Welles of the year. I watched it to see Mank. I still haven't seen Mank. Jingle Jangle 2020. This was was just so much fun, and it was so beautiful with amazing details down to the way every hair was done. Rear Window 1954 has a lot has already been said about this film. My favorite part is Thelma Ritter. She always knows exactly what's going on and why.
She's fine.
Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Yeah.
This really is the second first place. I love this movie. I'm so glad I got to see it in a theater with no distractions. The love story is really my sort of slow burn romance. One storyline that I keep coming back to is that of Sophie, who needs to get an abortion. And my number one is The Third Man.
Yeah.
I saw this movie on the 3rd of January. It is an excellent film with fascinating twists and turns. It's also the film that prepared me for what 2020 was going to be. A big theme of the film is how much life is worth. I met a lot of people who sound a lot like the villain in this film. If you haven't seen it, see The Third Man.
I think I've seen The Third Man more often in theaters than any other movie.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen that at least six, I think 5 or 6 times minimum. Like, I've seen that movie. Like, every time it's been re-released, or every time it's screened in town, I always try to go see it. It's so alive. it really just pops. It's one of the peppiest film noirs ever. Like, it's just got it's got a kooky energy, and I love that Joseph Cotten is, every time he tries to be, like, a proper film noir, like, anti-hero cool guy, he's humiliated in some way, and it's really funny. It's a funny movie, actually. Even though it's really bitter and sad.
I do like that Joseph Cotten is sort of a dork. He keeps it kind of grounded. And there's an honorable mention here for Bad Day at Black Rock, 1955. I'm not sure what to make of this film. It does, however, take on the hatred of Japanese Americans during World War II, and I haven't seen many films from that time do that. It even brings up while the father was being relocated, because that's how they refer to being sent to an internment camp, his son was fighting the war. At the museum I work at, we have similar stories and oral histories from veterans. It also has an older Spencer Tracy using judo and karate chopping down villains. I hope the two of you are doing well. Thank you for recommending more than a few of these movies, Jinxie.
Thank you. That actually is a great point, and I think it's something that a lot of film critics don't talk about. And the folks over at Ticklish Business are wonderful, and obviously we don't want to steal their bit, but it's a good conversation to have. And I know it's actually kind of hard to think about because we see so many movies, and so many of them we see for podcasts or work, but are there any older movies you didn't have to see, like, just because they're new releases? That really stood out for you and you were glad you got to discover in 2020. Does anything come to mind?
Well, all of the films that we watched for our streaming club, these were new films that we got to, that we sort of assigned to ourselves. And that was a pretty fun project. And I got to see a lot of really good movies that I hadn't seen before. I was actually really glad to rediscover The Searchers, a movie that for many years I really loathed. I saw it in film school when I was like maybe 19 or 20 and just hated it. Brazenly, outwardly hated it.
I always had mixed feelings about it. And then, you're right. This last time we saw it, I think we finally like found the right wavelength and it's a really good film.
It's been said that, films don't change. They're recorded, but the people who see them do. And it's worth revisiting these movies time and time again. And, I think a good bellwether for how great a movie is one that speaks to you repeatedly.
Yeah.
You can watch it and really dig it for one reason when you're young and then watch it and really dig it for another reason when you're old.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just as arbitrary a measure as any, but it seems valid to me.
Well, I mean, again, you're going to grow up, I hope, and you're going to have a long life, I hope, and you know, the art will be there. Mm. And if you're going to revisit it, it's certainly nice that it doesn't just stay stagnant. And, you know, it's nice to see a movie and it transports you back to when you were a kid or whatever. But to look at that same movie that you saw as a kid and look on it with new eyes and see something extra is an extra. It's like getting to watch it for the first time all over again, really. Mm. And that's kind of beautiful. We have a podcast on our Patreon called Only the Best, where we watch every Best Picture nominee ever. And a lot of the less famous nominees were first-time watches for me.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were really exciting. And I had a really wonderful time with them. And I wanted to give a couple of shout-outs to those. 100 Men and a Girl was such a delightful movie, and nobody talks about it. It is a movie set during the Great Depression, and it is about a teenage girl whose father is an out of work. I think he's a violinist. He's a musician in an orchestra, and he knows another. He's staying at like a big boarding house full of out of work musicians because it's the Great Depression and no one can afford to go to the see a concert. And she takes it upon herself to find a job for all of them. And she ends up scheming and shaming people, like rich people, into giving them money. And it ends up just being really fun and sweet. And there's this really great ending where the entire orchestra gets to play, like, inside a famous conductor's house.
It's Leopold Stokowski playing himself.
I couldn't remember the name. I knew you would. Leopold Stokowski, famous conductor. He was the conductor in Fantasia.
He's the conductor in all of the Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Also that. He was very famous at the time. And so, but there's this wonderful bit where it all culminates when he's like, I can't afford to hire all these people. It's just, it's not going to happen. But she pushes them all inside his house and he sees them all there and they're ready to play and he can't help himself. He has to conduct them. What a wonderful scene. that movie was great. Dead End really blew me away.
That was a really good one too.
Really, really great proto film noir, but also like a really great class melodrama as well. And an early villain role for Humphrey Bogart's fantastic. And it's from the director of photography of Citizen Kane. So it looks gorgeous. And one that's a bit more famous, but I'd never seen it before was Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Oh yeah. I'd seen that one before. I really like Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
It was really wonderful. It's a really sweet film about teaching. And it just made me bawl my eyes out. Beyond that, a couple of movies I saw for the first time. I'd never seen the Mel Brooks version of To Be or Not to Be.
Okay.
I've seen like a piece of it on TV here or there, but I finally just sat down and watched it. I really like that version. That version's really funny, and they're able to talk more openly about, and it, because that movie is set during the Nazi occupation of Poland as a bunch of, as an acting troupe tries to find a way to survive and then escape the occupation. But they're able to speak openly and candidly about the persecution of homosexuals in a way that the original couldn't. Yeah. And I actually think that was a really good thing to include. And it's actually really sympathetic and nicely done. I also saw a William Castle film called Let's Kill Uncle, which I just talked about on a podcast called Really Scared, R-E-E-L-Y. That movie is cool. And if you've never seen it, it's about a little kid and his rich father dies. And he goes to live on an island with his uncle. And his uncle is trying to kill the kid. And he flat out tells him. He says, listen, Barnaby, you're a charming young man, but you are not $5 million worth of charming. So I'm going to try to kill you. And if you can kill me first, you win. And it's awesome. It's so dark and fun. And it stars the girl from To Kill a Mockingbird.
Okay.
Co-stars her. And she's just wicked in it. She's like, ooh, we get to kill a guy? Let's do it. It's so twisted. It's so fun. Anyway, I got to see some fun movies. So, yeah.
You put me on the spot and my brain empties out.
I was so worried about that.
I've got nothing.
I hear you. It took me a minute. I was thinking about it while you were reading the letter. So I was able. I had a head start.
All right. Here's a letter from just simply A, the letter A.
Hi.
Hello. Is this the email you were looking for? Hello, is it me you're looking for?
Oh, it took me a second.
However, in all seriousness, I just watched Promising Young Woman and thought it was great. At the same time, it really fucked with me and my wife. Both of us have experienced the same kind of trauma that is the basis in this film. Mm. We rented the film based off of the trailer, which is not a proper advertisement for the actual film. Due to the subject matter, do you think a film like this should possibly have a warning about triggering, since its ads are so in opposition to its actual themes and ideas? Mm. I really like the film, but the ads should perhaps present differently, which I get it's similar in step to get in more similar step with the film itself.
Yeah.
And now I realize I've contradicted myself. However, the final film is not as advertised. If left to someone else who is not in the know, could it be viewed by somebody who is far too susceptible to hurt the themes of the film? Long story short, do you think advertising should try harder?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think it was Roger Ebert who said a lot of the people who make trailers use the grocery store toothpick sample approach.
Mm-hmm.
You go into a grocery store, you have a sample of cheese on a toothpick. You know everything you need to know about that cheese. The only thing that would, you'd gain by buying the cheese is just more of it.
Yeah.
And so he feels like a lot of trailers are cut that way. You get the entire movie. You get to know everything you need to know about the movie.
You just don't get to see it assembled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a tricky thing because a lot of movies want their stories or a lot of their characters to remain surprises.
Yeah.
Or to be told in a certain way. And the trailers can really give it all away. And yeah. A lot of people have complained about this in the past. I know there was a big to-do when Terminator 6 came out.
Terminator Genesis.
I guess you're right.
No, Dark Fate didn't really have the problem. It was Terminator Genesis, like, gave away every twist in the film.
Yeah, there was a big twist where one of the central figures of the series, John Connor, was revealed to be an evil super robot from the future now.
That plot point isn't until halfway through the movie, but they put it in the film.
They put it in the trailer. So I can openly discuss it. It was part of the advertising.
Yeah.
And that was a big surprise. That would have been a lot more fun if it was a surprise halfway through.
I wrote an article at the time. I don't know if it's still available, but it was called The Genesis Effect. And it's an issue where, and it's an issue that I think, I interviewed the writers of Terminator Genesis, and I was like, were you concerned about putting all these twists in like the first half of the movie? Because initially it seems like you're just remaking Terminator. And then there's the twist that Sarah Connor is actually already prepared for to meet a Terminator. In fact, she's already met one and he raised her. And now she's a bad...
In 1984.
So she's a badass younger and we've messed with the timeline. And wouldn't that have been a more interesting surprise if you didn't know it in the trailer? And then on top of it, John Connor's the bad guy and that's halfway through. And the problem is, to advertise that movie, to tell people what they're going to get so that they know they want to buy a ticket, they have to spoil it. And they were like, well, we can't write a movie that way. We just have to write it the best way we can to tell a story. And they weren't wrong. But I think we've entered into this realm where you need to factor in the fact that the movie needs to be marketed. And as much as cool as it is to read a story and find out 30 pages in that, you know, this nice rom-com set at an airport is actually a kidnapping story. Red Eye is the movie I'm referring to. You have to show that it's a thriller in the trailer because if people think it's a romantic comedy and then they go in there, this isn't what we paid to see. It might be good. It might be bad. Some people might even dig it, but it's not what we paid to see. And I think advertising responsibility to at least prepare people for what they're going to get, even if they're not specific about it.
There is a way to cut a trailer, maybe a short one, for Red Eye, without giving that away, with revealing that there's a thriller element to it, without giving away what the big twist is.
I remember the
original trailer was just a scene from the movie, where it was like the big turning point for the main character. There was a way to cut a trailer for a promising young woman that actually alludes to the themes of that movie.
I still maintain that the best trailer ever is the trailer for Psycho. Where Alfred Hitchcock...
There's no actual footage for the film.
Even the one shot that looks like it's from the film is not from the film. It's actually a different actor. But the whole movie is just Alfred Hitchcock walking around the Bates Motel talking about how something really bad happened here. But he's nonspecific. He just indicates that there was a horrible crime. And I think the implication is that there's a murder, but he doesn't tell you anything. He just sets the scene so that you know when you get there something bad's going to happen at this motel. But that's it. That's all you know. It's hard to do.
It's hard to do. I think advertising has played far too important a part of the conversation when it comes to films. Advertising only exists in this tiny little window before a film comes out, and then the film is going to go on forever thereafter.
And then the trailers will mostly be forgotten. Occasionally the good ones will be remembered, but usually they're sort of little tiny artistic
efforts unto themselves, but it's rare that you'll... I'm not even sure if people like will stick in a DVD and discover a trailer that way anymore. It was a big way. I discovered a lot of movies. I'd rent something from a couple of years ago and see previews from around that time and become familiar that way.
Nowadays, it's more likely that someone will be like, hey, remember like before we knew how bad the Roland Emmerich Godzilla was, they released these trailers that were like little mini movies that weren't in the film. And the mini movies were actually pretty good. Like this one fisherman who gets like thrown away by Godzilla, or when Godzilla like
stomps through the Natural History Museum.
That one was cool. That was cooler than the movie.
I was working at a video store when that preview hit, and a little kid came in. He was like maybe 8 or 9, and he said, "Do you have this? Like, this is a video store. The movie's not even out yet." And I think he didn't quite understand the concept of the teasers. He just thought the movie was already out there.
Yeah, the teaser exists, therefore the movie must be available.
So he came into a video store before the Godzilla movie was released in theaters and saying, hey, I need you to point out what this movie is. It's like, it's this woman's giving a tour through a natural history museum, and there's a Tyrannosaurus skeleton, and then this big foot comes through the ceiling and stomps on the Tyrannosaurus skeleton and then walks off. I said, I know what you're talking about. That's a Godzilla movie that's not out yet. But I led him over to, like,
the Godzilla section.
The 60s Godzilla movies, and I said, these are the Godzilla movies you want to watch to get ready for that.
I remember...
He didn't rent any of them. Oh, he wasn't interested.
I remember when I was a little kid, and I was renting movies at a place called The Warehouse. That was popular...
Where?
The Warehouse. It was a popular home video chain. I don't know how far it extended. It was very, very popular in Southern California anyway.
That is W-H-E-R-E House, Warehouse.
Yes. They rented movies and they also sold CDs and DVDs and VHSs back when they had them. But they had a big standee for robot jocks.
Yay!
And I can't remember what it was, but at least one of the movies that it would rent like over and over again because I had favorites had a trailer for Robot Jocks in front of it. And if you've ever seen Robot Jocks, you know how awesome that movie looks. And I always ask, like, hey, when does Robot Jocks come out? And they're like, we don't have Robot Jocks yet. Okay, cool. Years went by. They never ordered it. They had a standee. I appreciate that not every movie that has a trailer in front of a VHS is going to be carried at every store. They had a standee, and they never ordered a copy when it came out. It took me years to see that movie. It sucked. Anyway, but back to your point about advertising. Advertisers don't care about the movie. They don't. They care about getting you to buy a ticket. That's
the studios hire other firms to cut those trailers.
Yeah, it's very rare that a filmmaker has any input.
Indeed, a lot of the studios will only give certain scenes or certain pieces of the movie to advertisers to use in the trailers. The advertisers haven't seen the movie.
Yep.
They're not making those decisions. Yep. Sometimes you'll get a filmmaker who wants to make a trailer in a certain way.
Or has enough clout to have approval at the very least. But that's pretty rare.
It's really rare. I don't know who made the preview for A Serious Man, the Coen Brothers movie.
Oh, that was, yeah.
That's a brilliant trailer.
That was a good one.
Because it communicates a tone rather than events.
It was like a panic attack of a trailer.
It starts with a guy getting his head slammed repeatedly against a wall, and it turns into this rhythmic thing, and the edits turn into the rhythm of the head pounding. We see lines being repeated throughout. It's really, really excellent.
If the Coen Brothers weren't involved in that, whoever made that trailer was like a Coen fan. They knew what they were doing. That was a good one. But typically they're just trying to sell you tickets. And sometimes they're not even going to be honest. I remember there's a movie called August Osage County. Which is based on a play, and it's a very melodramatic, intense family drama with like harsh revelations and psychological abuse. And it's frankly, it's kind of a tough sit, even though everyone's really good in it. Well, most everyone's really good in it, but I remember when it came out, it was like a big Christmas release because they were pushing it for Oscar consideration. And there was a trailer I saw on Comedy Central. It was like during the Daily Show where they took all of the scenes from the movie that could be kind of funny and they sold it as a comedy.
Yeah.
And I'd already seen it. I was offended. I was pissed because people are going to hate that movie. Because that's not what that is at all. They're going to go in thinking someone's going to see that trailer and see the movie thinking this is a fun Christmas movie or something where a family gets together and it's kind of wacky and we all learn a valuable lesson. And then, oh my God, it just ruins their night and the family hates them now. And it's just brutal. Mm. So then on top of it, when we get with Promising Young Woman, that's a story with very directly tackles themes of sexual assault on a variety of levels. And that is going to be a hard sit for a lot of people. A lot of people very, very, very tragically have personal experience with something like that, or they know someone who has, and that can really make it a tough sit, even if it is good. Some people are perfectly, able to enjoy a story like that and confront the awfulness of it. But some people aren't there yet or aren't there right now or just don't want to today. And that's perfectly valid too. So I almost wish we could do is we could take the MPAA rating and make it less about just the quantity of violence and more about content warning and more, because there are a lot of like, okay, this is something bad happens to a dog in this movie. People want to know that. A lot of people want to know that. A lot of people like, just can't handle it. Or as opposed to they say the F word a few times. Don't care. Don't care. But you, something that actually people would want to know and be prepared for or know that they don't want to see it, that's probably more valuable information. I don't know. That's a thought.
And this just highlights how kind of useless the rating system has become.
Yeah.
You can just say, here's an R-rated film. Well, that can mean so many things.
It could mean anything.
If we lent credence to that, we'd understand. If we're going to see an R-rated film, that's probably something a little bit more adult. It's going to be a little bit more aggressive. We are prepared for that.
Yeah.
The R rating doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, it has like, oh, adult content or adult things. And I know they've gotten a little bit more descriptive, but really, you know, the things that we need to know and the things that we need to highlight bigger than the R are things like this movie has psychological abuse or this movie has, you know, scenes in which... children are in peril. Some people just can't handle that right now. I'm a new parent. I can't stand to see, you know, a kid, you know, being kidnapped or something. Yeah, I don't know.
Try having a young child and watching the movie The Nightingale at some point.
There you go. Yeah. Exactly. That movie really deserves its rating. But like, regardless, it's brutal. And you should probably have an idea of what you're getting into.
And there are websites that have that, that sort of break down beat by beat the things that are... perhaps objectionable for like a younger audience or a more sensitive audience. Not in a finger wagging way. They're not doing it to censor. They're just spelling it a little bit more explicitly.
There are a few that are, but that's not necessarily true.
No, there are some that just sort of lay it out. So you have a better idea as to what's in the movie because the MPAA doesn't do that.
And again, I remember you used to just have to deal with it. If something happened in a movie that was like really intense and there's a certain power to that. But it's a power that needs to be wielded wisely. And I think that expecting everyone in your audience to just be able to take whatever you dish out is just not where we are right now. I don't think it's a good tactic. I think it's better if you don't care, then you don't need to read all this stuff or find out all this stuff or pay attention to this stuff. But if you do, that information should be readily available. And I think that should be a bit more what advertising is about, telling you what you're going to get. Maybe not in spoilery detail, but preparing you so that when the movie happens, you're not mad at it or it doesn't ruin your night and you might be more inclined to like it. Anyway, we should move on.
Here's a letter from...
Thank you for your email, by the way. That was a really great topic.
Yeah. Here's a letter from Joshua.
Hello, hi.
Joshua. Happy Infrastructure Week, Mr. Bibbs and McCool. If you're not already overrun by them, I would like to provide my favorite films of the clusterfuck that was 2020. Firstly, honorable mentions, the works and goings on of TikTok is on the best of the year list.
You know what? Yeah. A lot of people on TikTok helped us get through 2020, and I'm going to give a shout out. There's a lot of really fun filmmaking going on in that medium, and we don't get a chance to talk about it very often.
Oh, I forgot who said it, but they said that film would not be considered art until the camera is as prevalent as pen and paper. Like, a camera has to be really widely available to many, many people. This was said back in, I think, the 60s. This might have been a Truffaut-ism. Now they are. People have cameras in their pockets. Most people have own cameras now.
Yeah.
Most of the people I know, anyway. And so... yeah, TikTok, people are making short films.
Yeah, they're
for
fun. There's a lot of fun films.
Using clever editing and timing and jokes and acting.
Yeah, really neat editing some tricks actual, on TikTok. Yeah. I'm not going to lie. Like, I've actually, like, I've seen, like, 30-second things on TikTok, and I'm like, that should be taught in the class.
Yeah.
How many clever edits there were in 30 seconds in someone's bedroom. Like, that was really cool.
I saw these two high school kids were playing a game of table tennis. And they started by bouncing it off of paddles, but every time they edited, and it was edits like looking at one player, then looking at the other player.
Yeah, shot, reverse shot.
And they every time they reversed shot, they were no longer holding a ping pong paddle, but some other wild object.
Okay,
it's like they bounced the ball with a blender, and then holding a whole television set,
fun.
Tennis racket, that sort of thing. And then the last shot, you see the final player holding a live cat. About to hit the ball with a live cat. But as the ball moves into frame, it hits the table. And, they switched it with an egg, and it just cracks on the table. And that's the end of the video.
That's fine.
It's great comic timing.
That feels
it's
like
really
a Buster
clever.
Keaton routine.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's a really good one. I like
and that's
that.
Just two high school kids dicking around in their basement.
Good.
Yeah.
That's great. That's inspired.
This generation is giving me so much hope.
That's really cool. All right, but anyway, thank you. That's a great shout out. I don't see any other critic do that. Someone should have done that. That's smart.
I put a Quibi film on my list.
You put a Quibi film, yes. But just TikTok in general, that's clever. I fully support it.
Other honorable mentions: Host, City Hall, Sound of Metal, Martin Eden. I didn't see Martin Eden.
I didn't see it either.
Color Out of Space, Boys State. I heard good things about that one.
Yeah, I didn't see that one.
Borat, subsequent movie film, Da Five Bloods, and The Assistant.
Okay.
Now to the proper top 10. Number 10 is I'm Thinking of Ending Things. No one makes movies quite like Charlie Kaufman, but that uniqueness made each of his films at least interesting to me and quite a bit transcendent. While I have some issues with this entry to his oeuvre, no one makes hopeless depression so beautifully.
My opinion on the film is well noted. I'm not going to take away any steam from you the way I would from Whitney when he talks about this movie. I didn't like it as much as you did, but I'm glad you enjoyed it.
You start letting air out of my balloon before it's even inflated, sir.
Sorry.
Number 9, Another Round. I feel when
This
is the Mads Mikkelsen alcoholism movie.
Yeah.
I feel when alcoholism is shown in American culture, there are two ways it's portrayed, either as humorous or as an irreversible tragedy. Seeing a nuanced take by someone as skilled as Thomas Vinterberg makes it a refreshing watch. Number 8, Totally Under Control. Drive you crazy. I may be picking relevance rather than quality here, but who cares? I feel that this film will be looked upon in the future to at least give a broad overview of what we were feeling and thinking during the times we're currently living through. That's the Alex Gibney documentary about the Trump administration's bungling of the coronavirus.
I think there's a tendency for people, and I've done this myself, to say that it's, you know, it can be more effective to wait until we have some perspective on a time before we start making movies about what it meant. However, and they can be really, really hit or miss, but I think there's a lot of value to people trying to do it in the time. Again, they might whiff it completely, but their effort is interesting. And when we look back on the movies made about an era during that era, it can be incredibly telling whether or not they're good.
Yeah, I liked that HBO series we watched for Cancel Too Soon called Here and Now, which is about the here and now. And it had some weird twists in it, but it tried to deal with some pretty heady topics, like, as they were coming out in the conversation.
Yeah.
And not always successfully, but I admired the effort.
Exactly, yeah.
Number
it'll
seven,
be interesting to watch like 20 years from now. But like, what was it like back then? That's not a bad example.
Number 7, Palm Springs, an entertaining and at times profound modern take on Groundhog Day, which adopts some nihilistic philosophy and is given higher significance for me due to the accidental parallel to the routine of quarantine.
That's a good point, actually. No, it was a really good movie, and it came very... all my runners-up came pretty close to being in my top 10, but I really liked that movie a lot.
Here's an interesting one I don't know. Number 6, I Was Home, But... one of the strangest and most fascinating films I saw last year, as well as being one of the last films I saw in a theater, again, with whose monotonous tone gained more significance the year later for me. But otherwise, the commentary on the medium of the film, including references to Ozu and Bresson, really excite me. Mm. Yeah, Ozu made a film called I Was Born, But. I don't know this film. I Was Home, But.
It's about like a kid who, like, disappears and then comes back, and, you know, all the questions that raises. I think it's a Russian movie. That's all I know, really. I missed it out. I remember hearing it was good, but that's all I got.
Vitalina Varela. This is one I really wanted to see, and I didn't get around to. The greatest piece of pure slow cinema of the year. A masterpiece of mood, emotion, and cinematography. Number 4, First Cow. Kelly Reichardt is a master of her craft. Her films feel perfect when you watch them, and not in a cold, calculating way. There's a humanity to her characters and the world they live in that makes them such a joy to watch. I agree. I love First Cow.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Number 3, Soul.
Oh, yeah.
While I understand the critiques some of this Pixar entry it has and some plot points, the reason this ranks so highly for me is due to the final message of appreciating life's moments really resonates with me now, and I think of small moments that I took for granted, things like going into a bar and getting a pint and watching a basketball game or going to a museum or hugging my mom. Maybe any other year this wouldn't have hit so hard, but in 2020 it worked for me.
It's an okay movie. I think it's the kind of movie I think would, if I'd been younger, it would have hit me harder. And again, it's Pixar. That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
But I think I just was ready for something a bit more nuanced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not going to respond unless it properly emotionally destroys me.
Which, to be fair, Pixar does a lot.
They're capable of it. They've done it, before.
Many times they've done that.
I watched Inside Out a second time at a drive-in, and it still made me weep. Like, so I knew it was coming, and it
I'm
still
afraid
made me weep.
To see Coco again because it wrecked me constantly. It's such a good film.
Yeah.
I think Coco is one of the reasons why I didn't care for Soul as much either, because I felt like they covered a lot of the same ground.
Yeah,
and I thought that Coco did it with a bit more. I think life, that makes well, I think vibrancy, but also the fact that there was a cultural specificity to the afterlife actually, I think, gave it a lot more personality and power to me rather than this sort of what is the absolute neutral state of the afterlife where there's no religious inclination whatsoever. There's no cultural history to it. We're going to reduce. It's going to be science, but the science that doesn't exist. And that's interesting as an academic exercise, but as a movie, I think Coco hit me a lot harder because of the specificity.
Yeah. Number two is Disclosure.
Do I know this one?
I heard a lot of critiques of this one, actually. As a transgender person, this felt important to see, and I'm incredibly happy it exists, and I'm hoping it leads to more representation in the near future. I wish it wasn't so necessary, and that the history of transgender cinema wasn't so bare. Yeah, this was I think it was a Netflix documentary. It was about
the
history
of
trans characters in cinema.
Yeah, okay.
And I've heard that it doesn't go nearly far or deep enough. That was the critique I heard.
I haven't seen it, so I couldn't say. But
And number one is Small Axe. Yeah. Many words have been said, written, praising this masterpiece. I'll just say it seems like a truly important moment in cinema history. Kind regards, Joshua. Well, thanks for writing in, Joshua.
I'm really interested in how, like, people are talking about the best movies of the year, and, you know, and not all of them are this, but how often we're trying to look at it as we're going through such a tumultuous, turbulent, scary time in history. And what are the movies that we're going to take with us that we're going to, like, define this era, that we're going to point to and say it was like that? And that's going to be an interesting conversation, and I'm not sure everyone's going to agree on what movies those are, even the ones that we're trying to, and some of the ones that weren't, and just ended up feeling kind of like Palm Springs is a good example, where I doubt they were thinking about that. They couldn't possibly. The movie but like premiered at Sundance before the pandemic started, and yet, you're right. The idea of living in isolation where every day is the same as the last, and you can't really go anywhere, and it doesn't seem like you have any future. And you're just trying to make the most out of what's currently available to you because you're just trapped with one person in a room. A lot of people went through that ended up actually being a very timely film through no intention of the filmmakers. And yet it was kind of perfect.
Some films are seen as better or worse depending on when they come out.
Timing can be a lot of things.
I remember the whole fiasco with the Sicario sequel, and about how it came out, like, I think the same week as all of the news started to come out about what was going on at the American border.
And
that was a story about, like, drug cartels at the American border, sort of romanticized violence version of it.
Like, it's so bad down there, it's a good thing
it seemed like... Instantly, it was, like, naive and dated. And there was, Catherine Keener's in the movie. She has a line of dialogue about how, this president doesn't care about winning. He just cares about, hang on a second.
We thought there'd be another president. Yeah. We thought there'd be another. And even, like, shortly afterwards, when the actual president started talking about stuff that he heard happening at the border, where there was actually no evidence whatsoever that it ever happened, except in that Sicario movie.
Yeah, he was using it as evidence of the real world.
That was fucking weird.
Because he's dumb. As we record this, we're going to have a new president tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
So we're holding our breath in this last leg.
No, the one I keep thinking of actually that was like so timely until it wasn't, and then it ended up being accidentally more timely, is The Purge election year.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
The Purge election year, I still think it's the best film in that series. And again, the premise.
Oh, by far, yeah.
conservatives taken over. This weird fringe extremist conservative movement has taken over American politics, and they have created an annual holiday in which all crime, including murder, is legal for 12 hours once a year, ostensibly for this moralistic reason, you know, like in that Star Trek episode, to just get out all of our negativity all at once, and then we'll be better to each other throughout the year.
Festival!
But in actuality, it's a means of decreasing the size of the population, and it exponentially affects people in lower income classes and also people of color. And as election year came around, the third movie in the series, I started dealing with that directly. And it ended up being about a woman who was actually running for president, and she was running on a platform of, we're going to stop the purge. And the conservatives were like, no, we're not going to do that. And so they actually basically sicked their entire following on her by saying, you know, we're going to let people kill politicians this year during the purge. And then the movie ends, spoiler alert, you can skip ahead a few seconds if you're worried about it, you haven't seen it yet, but it ends with Hillary Clinton winning, and then all of the conservatives in America decide, fuck it, we're going to purge anyway. The die has been cast, the genie's been let out of the bottle, and everyone's so used to letting their rage and their ignorance fuel them that they're just going to storm the Capitol building. That movie is weirdly ahead of its time, but for a couple of years, because they anticipated that, like, Hillary Clinton was going to win, like, that was the ending, is Hillary Clinton-esque character wins. For a bit, it seemed like, okay, we might have taken the franchise in a direction where it's not going to be as topical for a bit, and then it got topical again.
Yeah.
And again, I think when we look back on things, I think the Purge movies are going to end up feeling like John Carpenter's They Live, where they were very in your face, but they were also kind of on point. Yeah. Anyway, that was at the end of the letter.
That was the end of the letter.
Yeah. That's a great top 10 list. I need to see a couple of those movies, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. I want to see that Ozu one.
Ozu-esque
film. Ozu is dead.
Yeah.
It's not making movies anymore.
Sadly. I had a dream once where I accidentally wound up in a movie theater, and it was a premiere of a new Orson Welles movie, and I had ended up in heaven, and their filmmakers got to keep making movies.
Ah, okay.
Boy, was that a great dream. It was a wonderful dream. So I like to think that Ozu and Welles and all these other filmmakers who we really care about and would love to see new films, they're out there, and, you know, someday we might get to see them.
I'd like to think that
they're a fantasy.
I'd like to think that they're sort of like retired now.
Well, if they want to, if they don't, keep making movies. Why not?
So, I guess, you know, afterlife, there's no exhaustion. Just keep working.
Yeah.
One more letter?
Yeah, we got one more.
All right. Here's a letter from Ryan. Hey guys, hope you're chilling. Like a villain. After hearing a previous letter yet again extolling the virtues of Portrait of a Lady on Fire, I wanted to write in a personal quibble to perhaps prompt discussion.
Okay.
When I saw Portrait of a Lady on Fire, I thought it was good. I didn't see the indisputable mastery that so many others did. Perhaps this is because of my experience of the ending. Keeping things as spoiler-free as possible, the ending involves a piece of classical music which reminds the lead character of another moment earlier in the film when the same music is played. There are tears, etc. Putting aside the obvious gripe that it visually has lifted the whole Call Me By Your Name thing, the scene failed to strike me because I didn't realize that the two classical pieces were the same.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. Classical music sounds like a lot of formless plinking to me. Which is the same how all jazz sounds like so much formless noodling.
Okay.
So it took my girlfriend enlightening me afterwards to understand the scene. Thus, my own ignorance robbed the ending of its power. So finally, my question. Has your pure first viewing of a film ever been so compromised that you feel you'll have forever missed out on something? Thanks, and keeping on, Ryan.
Ryan, thank you so much for that. And that's actually a good point, actually. And it's something we tend to forget. You've pointed out on more than one occasion that we tend to use the word pretentious wrong. We tend to use the word pretentious to mean sort of stuck up, you know, snobby. When pretentious actually means...
If you look at the root of the word.
Yeah, it actually means to assume that the audience knows everything that you're talking about. And in particular, this is relevant when you're talking about things that are not simplistic or universal when you're talking about things like books you may have read or music you may have heard, to use this specific example.
You might assume that a certain piece of music, a certain piece of literature is universally known.
Yeah.
And you talk about it as if it's universally known, and turns out maybe a lot of people don't know that thing.
Exactly. An example that comes to mind, even though it's not movies specifically, is over the course of the pandemic, I have gotten more into following different sort of areas of YouTube.
Okay.
And one of the things that I've gotten into, because my wife and partner, Emma Lopez da Silva, is very much interested in The Sims, the video game, is sort of a creative thing. And we started watching people in the Simmer online community. And there's one who I'm very, I think is actually very interesting, named Plumbella. That is their, you know, YouTube handle. And she tends to edit clips from what I can only imagine are reality TV shows. Mm-hmm. And they'll just cut to a line that sounds like it's from a reality TV show. It is full of all of these references to things that I haven't watched.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
And I understand that the joke exists, but I don't get it.
Hmm.
I find that kind of fascinating, actually, that there's this, it's contemporary popular culture, and I'm completely removed from it.
Hmm.
It's almost like being a kid again. Like, when I was a kid and I was watching movies that referenced, you know, classical works of art or books I haven't read yet, I knew what they were talking about, but I didn't understand the specifics of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a reading Mad Magazine and they make a Cries and Whispers joke.
Yeah.
So you haven't seen Cries and Whispers when you're eight. At least I hope you haven't.
Eventually you pick up on the fact that that's Ingmar Bergman. Mm. He's a filmmaker who makes movies that kind of look like this. And a lot of people, when they reference art house cinema, they're going after Ingmar Bergman. But you still might not have seen Cries and Whispers.
Mm.
So this happens. And I think Portrait of Lady on Fire is an interesting example of that. I think your illusion to Call Me By Your Name isn't quite the same, because I think the ending of Call Me By Your Name isn't so much a specific callback musically so much as it is Timothée Chalamet looking sad while a cool song plays.
Well, yeah.
That's a reduction of what the scene is about, but it's not quite the callback that I think Call Me By Your Name is. And I think the filmmaker, I think Celine Sciamma, attempts in that early scene to clarify specifically the music and play enough of it that hopefully you recognize it later, even if you don't. Mm. But I also think that, yeah, I think she's relying on that piece of classical, you know, orchestral music to be something you've probably heard before.
Yeah.
And it will do a little bit of the heavy lifting of that scene. And if you're not familiar with classical music, you might have missed that one.
Mm.
That's actually a fair point.
I suppose so. Might dull the impact. I think the film plays just fine without that recognition. I think there's a sustained shot of one of the characters that's heartbreaking, even if you don't know the piece of music in question.
But if you understand the context, I think the scene is a lot more powerful. Yeah,
usually when I see something like that, I'm moved to learn. I want to figure out what is the significance of that piece of music? What's the history of it? And thanks to the internet, I can look that up immediately. It just sort of wants me to expand my horizons a little bit rather than just sort of resent that I missed something.
Yeah. I remember seeing... I'm
trying to think of like an example of did miss out on something.
I remember seeing What's Opera, Doc.
Oh, yeah.
Classic Looney Tune cartoon starring Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd.
Mm.
And it is a really spirited, dramatic parody of opera. What's the name of the opera in that? Is it Flight of the Valkyries or something?
It's Wagner.
It's Wagner. It's not specifically one. Okay, but I don't know.
Oh, they do sing Flight of the Valkyries.
They're spoofing off of opera. When I was a kid, all I knew about opera was the cartoon I was currently watching. I knew the concept of opera because I'd seen it parodied in cartoons before, but I don't know more than that. I still don't know a lot more than that. I've never really gotten into opera. I know enough to understand what I'm seeing, but I've never been to the opera.
Mm.
So I'm probably still not getting enough of What's Opera, Doc. Mm. They're smart filmmakers. They probably filled it with a lot of, like, when I noticed that, like, when they did parody things like older movies, like gangster movies, like Edward G. Robinson stuff, like, I would get that stuff because I was watching those movies. My mom was watching those movies with me when I was a kid, so I had that baseline. So there's probably stuff in there that I'm still not picking up on.
Sorry. Well, you're fine. Knocked a thing.
But that's an example there where I don't fully know everything I'm missing in that. I still get it. It's still funny, but it's not the same, is it?
Yeah. I remember you and Dave White talking about a film called Cemetery of Splendor.
Oh, yeah. And, yes. Which that's is a good example,
Abhi Chopong Weir's ethical film. And it's about a hospital for soldiers who have fallen asleep and just don't wake up. Mm-hmm. And they don't know the cause of this. Mm-hmm. And they can, like, answer questions. I don't remember what the actual...
It's a little weird. It's a weird premise, basically. Yeah. But yeah, like, they're not really comatose.
Yeah.
They're just asleep. It's a strange premise and a strange film.
I've not seen Cemetery of Splendor, but I have seen Uncle Boon Mee. I've seen a few other Abhi Chopong Weir's ethical films, and he makes films that are very, very Thai.
Mm-hmm.
They're very much of Thailand, his home country. And when you were talking about Cemetery of Splendor, and Dave White as well mentioned this, there's probably something so culturally specific about that particular film that as an American audience, we're just not going to know unless we've lived in Thailand or know a lot of Thai people.
We're always going to be a little distance from it because we just don't live there. Yeah. And and this is often true. Like, a lot of films from other countries that are really steeped in that culture don't even get released in America because it might be full of, like, wordplay that we're not going to get translated, no matter how good the translation is, because that's just not the way it works.
I was astonished that a film like District 9 got as much traction as it did in America, because that is a very South African movie.
Yeah.
Deals with very specific South African politics. I find that kind of exposure to something I don't quite understand or a piece of art whose significance I don't quite get to be thrilling.
Can be.
I like it because I know I'm being exposed to something, even though I don't understand it in the moment.
Mm-hmm. It's like being dropped into, like, a part of the world and you've no plan to be there. You don't know the
language. It's like a little spoonful of complete immersion, if that's possible.
Yeah.
So rather than resent the fact that maybe Portrait of a Lady on Fire didn't quite work well for you because you didn't understand one piece of music.
Which isn't necessarily what they're saying, but, you know, because I just didn't hit him as hard.
Yeah. Maybe it didn't hit you for other reasons. Maybe if knowing that piece of music wouldn't have helped. Maybe there's just something about that film that's not hitting your wavelength. Whatever the reason, that's fine. I personally happen to love it. I would recommend it to anyone.
Same.
But don't put resentment on the film. Try to adjust it as being introduced to something.
Yeah.
Something that's new and exciting. Look into that piece of music. See what makes that distinct from all of those other pieces of classical music that you find it indistinguishable from.
Right. And again,
see why it is distinguishable.
You don't have to do this, but it can be really illuminating. And I mentioned it before.
Process.
Well, I mentioned it before. We do a podcast on this feed called Episode Zero, in which we look at the films that set the precedent for movies that are more ubiquitously known now. So right now we're in the middle of Rocky Horror. Mm. But we started off with 20 episodes about the films that influenced Star Wars, many of which I'd seen before.
Mm.
You know, I'd seen some of the Flash Gordon serials, or I'd seen King Kong, or I'd seen The Wizard of Oz. But there were a few that I hadn't, and boy, did they completely change the way that I view Star Wars. In particular, I'm thinking of the film 2187.
Okay.
George Lucas.
So it's 21-87.
Yeah, George Lucas. A lot of people know that George Lucas based Star Wars on World War II films like the Dam Busters or samurai films like the Hidden Fortress. But what a lot of people don't talk about, and it's constantly referenced in the movies, it's the number of Leia's jail cell in New Hope. Finn's stormtrooper code number in A Force Awakens is 2187. There was a short film called 2187, and it is an assemblage of pre-existing footage from a variety of different sources, and it is edited together in such a way that it describes the interconnectivity of all things. It's an incredibly ambitious short film, and it's surprisingly effective considering its ambitions.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at that film, I recommend listening to our episode about it, because when you look at that short film, 2187, and you think about it in context, not just with Star Wars, but George Lucas's whole filmography, including THX 1168. 1138, sorry. Including THX, including American Graffiti. You start to notice the way that Lucas is creating parallels, and this is the way that Lucas thinks about different passages of time.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, my perspective on Star Wars, I like Star Wars.
Mm.
You know, not all of it, but like I've been a fan. But my perspective on Star Wars changed dramatically since I not only saw that, a reference that some people have heard of, oh, yeah, it's based on a short story or a short film. But once you actually watch it and once you actually think about it, the veil is lifted. Yeah. And now I'm looking at this entirely different way. And in some respects, it's a lot better.
Yeah, we found, Star Wars takes place a long time ago, and that's significant.
Yeah.
And how THX 1138 takes place in the future. The past is a place where morality is simple and fun and light.
Yeah.
The future is a place where emotion is dead and people are now part machine.
Mm-hmm. And American Graffiti is about immediacy.
It's about...
We're not really concentrating on bigger issues. Living.
It's about youth. It's about your immediate past. That's a very nostalgic movie.
Yeah, it is, but it's also relatively contemporary compared to the others.
But 2187 was the one that takes place in the present, right when things are starting to unravel. Right when the connection is being lost, there's something very like a lamentation quality about that.
Yeah, and basically it is the Force. It's basically that short film, and the way we look at that and as it permeates through Star Wars changes when you see it. And the film's like 10 minutes long, and it's easy to find online. You should check it out. It's really interesting. And we did a whole episode where we break it down in way more detail than we just did. But again, I didn't know that when I saw Star Wars. I saw Star Wars as a kid with a laser sword fighting a Black Knight. It turned out to be his dad. Like, that's what I got out of it. But now that I actually broke down the pretension and actually tried to focus on all of the things that did go into it, and he called his shots.
Mm.
No one's, it's not obscure. He put the name of the movie in his movie. I got more out of it. I think it's more interesting. So I think you'll get more out of Portrait of Lady on Fire if you can recognize that music. If you can't, it will change things a little bit.
Yeah, look up that piece of music.
That'd be a great opportunity.
Listen to it independently of the film.
Yeah.
Listen to it a couple times and then go back and watch the film.
Maybe do a little research, find out about the composer and what they were thinking of at the time. Yeah. That could be really exciting.
Because the filmmakers are definitely putting that kind of thought in
if they're doing their job.
Some filmmakers don't. Some filmmakers do, and it's kind of a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a song selection can have like an extra metatextual commentary going on.
Yeah.
I saw this really harrowing, almost awful movie called "The Killer Inside Me."
Oh, I missed that one.
It's about a serial killer, and there's a lot of just exploitation of women in that movie. It's really gross.
Isn't Jessica Alba in that?
Jessica Alba was in it. Casey Affleck was in it. Okay. If you listen to the soundtrack, and it's all these sort of like down homey kind of pop hits from like the early 50s, like country songs. And when you look up the song list, you realize each one of those songs was written and performed by somebody who went to prison for murder. It adds this little extra element to it. If you know a lot about that kind of music, then it's going to be adding a lot more texture to it.
Yeah, you're going to pick up on stuff that other people aren't, and that can be really exciting.
Yeah.
Good point. All right, that is it for We've Got Mail. Thank you for that great letter, by the way. That was an interesting conversation. But that is it for We've Got Mail this week. Thank you, everybody who wrote in. If we didn't get your email, we'll try next week, but keep trying. If it's super important, let us know. We're on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibbiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
And once again, that email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. If you want more exclusive content from Critically Acclaimed, you can head on over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We've talked about some of those podcasts this week. That's about Only the Best, our Oscars podcast. We have a Star Trek podcast, a Batman podcast, a Disney podcast. We do commentary tracks. A lot of exclusive stuff is available over there. We're incredibly grateful to all of our patrons, without whom even this free channel would not still exist. We just wouldn't be able to do it. So everyone who can afford to contribute and has been able to do so, we're incredibly grateful to you. Thank you. And anyone new who's interested, there's a lot of content just waiting for you right there, right now. at the press play, press start, already there. yeah, and of course, we have a lot of other stuff right here on the channel. So thank you, everybody, for subscribing, leaving us a review wherever you find us. And especially thank you, everybody, in this podcast for writing in. It's wonderful to hear your thoughts, hear your perspectives, the things that concern you, the things that you're interested in. Sometimes we don't know what people need to hear about or want to hear about or haven't had as part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And they're really fascinated by, because there's so much to talk about all the time. And I'm just really grateful that we get to do it. So thank you, everybody. Once again, you're awesome. Stay awesome. Stay safe. Please. It's a hard year already. We don't want another 2020. We want it to be a little rough at the beginning and then smooth sailing, right?
That's it.
Let's make it happen. Thank you once again. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Winnie.